Many of us happily said goodbye to poetry in high school. After all, why spend so much energy struggling with images and metaphors? Why worry about meter and rhyme when the same thing could be said much more expeditiously in prose? Well, that is not how Lee Mallory thinks of poetry. He is himself a poet, but not one who keeps himself secluded by his notebook or laptop. He reaches out into the community to perform poetry and bring it to people who may never have thought about it before. In fact, he says he wants to be the king of poetry in Las Vegas. He joins us now. Lee Mallory, welcome to KNPR.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
It's good to have you here. So why does Las Vegas need a king of poetry? We got Elvis, right?
Well, I would just say that poetry is a very big tent, and there are no kings of poetry per se. But I think with the artifice of Vegas, the fantasy of Vegas, forgive me for saying the pretense of Vegas, poetry will be very important because it helps people get re-anchored. It brings them back to the what we can call the universal truths, love, nature, our sense of estrangement. Those are the universals that bind us together as humanity. And certainly Vegas has plenty of need for that.
Yeah, nature.
Getting outdoors, getting out of the city, getting out of the casinos, getting away from the slots, the bells, the whistles, the billboards, all the facades of escapism that people hunger for because of the stresses of the world, which are everywhere around us here. Drive out of town a little ways and you've got beautiful mountainscapes. Mm. I love the wind myself. Long before I got here, I was writing lines of poetry such as, "The wind is a man's eyes that question every woman." And just that need to get out of town, get out of Dodge. The irony is that people get out of town, get out of Dodge, and come here for escape. So once again, if poetry can help get us back to our bearings, to our roots, to those essentials that bind us together as human beings, there's certainly a place for it here.
So when you're getting into it like that, how do you get more people to do the deep dive into poetry, to get into some of the things that are so elemental, as you just described?
Well, it's not easy because, in my opinion, poetry has been largely ruined, or the appreciation for poetry has been upset by bad high school teachers, bad college teachers that force the students to learn rhyme schemes, send them home with homework to memorize 10 lines in hexameter or this or that, who are too much into the embroidery of poetry and forget the fact that poetry can bring us to the essential meanings of our lives.
So teachers all too often emphasize structure over content.
Right. To my mind, poetry should be more of a celebration and less cerebration, which means it's not about memorizing, it's not about artifice, it's not about putting sing-song, moon, tune, June rings on the words. It's about dealing with the essentials of the human condition.
In ancient times, poetry tended to be repeated over and over, so people would get it into their heads, like today's pop songs, I guess. But when people almost never read poetry, are our ears ready to listen?
Well, it's really sad because if you look at the European tradition, children are raised on poetry. Children in French schools, for one, poetry becomes a very big part of their lives at a very young age. Poetry is woven into the very culture and civilization. Here we're dealing in sound bites, text messages on phones, computers, which are wonderful tools for us, but which can be very cold in the cyber world and lead to feelings of estrangement, feelings of alienation. I mean, a man in a cubicle talking to a coworker when he could stand up and communicate some important information, he just types an email. Or more profoundly and sadly, a partner may break up with a mate vis-a-vis a text message. Mm-hmm. People sometimes telephone the next guy secretly hoping they don't answer so they can simply record a voicemail. And so all these tools that bring us together wonderfully and would hopefully help us to communicate better can also be estranging us too.
Yeah, but is there opportunity in those tools? You know, if you can get a poem into 140 characters, or if text messages might give you this challenge to try to just kind of condense thoughts into short phrases.
There's a place for that. There's a place for anything, being able to send a poem at rapid speed from Nevada to California or consult with a publisher, an editor. Again, they're wonderful tools. There's a tension there in my life, at least. I'm a little bit wary of the cyber world.
I'm kind of a Luddite.
Yeah. Let's get up and give somebody a hug rather than sending a text message. Mm-hmm. Let's go seek someone out for a kiss. I am called after all the love poet, which is a little hokey. It sounds like some late night disc jockey broadcasting on staticky radio from Kansas. But I look at my themes, I look at my topics. It generally is that, what some would call the delicious combat between the sexes.
So in the delicious combat, even though that's it's such a rich and fertile area, what do you do to get people to listen to your poetry?
Well, the beauty of poetry overall, and to my mind, listeners that aren't schooled in poetry can just look at a simple definition. I'd say poetry is just that dense, supercharged, highly compressed language that helps us to express our high moments or our low moments in a lasting way that, in a sense, makes the writer immortal. And more importantly than that, helps a reader or a listener to identify with those very same feelings. Listeners have come up to me after I read perhaps about the death of a daughter. I did lose a daughter to suicide in 1999. And they come up, and although they don't know anything about alliteration, they know little about assonance, they don't know anything about poetry at all, they come up and say, well, that poem really touched me. I felt just that way at the services for my mom or my dad. So in that sense, the poet experiences the greatest joy to know that there's been a communion between a writer and a listener, or a writer and a reader.
So the reward is for people who hear or encounter this poetry, but it's for the poet as well.
Absolutely. For years and years, I used to tell college creative writing students that they should keep journals, not as fragments of polished writing, but just as work points for future poems or short stories. That if they would go to that ledger in the night when they're tired, they're home from work, the last thing they want to do is think about writing. But if they would go to it and just talk about the highs and lows of the day, that's the detritus of our lives. The babies, the bills, the good luck, the bad luck, the broken motors, the loves lost and won, that's all important, and put it in a journal. If you take one of those entries as a work point and it becomes a jewel set as the centerpiece in a lovely and lasting poem, it goes on forever. But I learned that lesson when my daughter died, because she had just finished a manuscript, and it became a book published posthumously by a bona fide publisher. It sits on my coffee table, and here we are 15 years later. And I can still pick up her book. She says softly, Daddy, don't worry. I'm here now. I'm still talking to you. We are together in these words, in this book, in these poems. And so it occurred to me that all this palaver I'd been putting out for years and years was really true. It came true for me personally.
We're talking with Las Vegas-based poet Lee Mallory. Do you read your own poetry when you're out? Can you read us one of your poems?
Sure. In a bar, I wonder. In a bar, I wonder what to say. Toes in sawdust, head in smoke, holding to an untold hope. Openings, an opening. Her tablet, her thigh, is a salt flat waiting for a record. But we stack words against our heat, and I cup the pale shoulder, search her softness, scrabble in tongues. Oh, red hibiscus, oh, celestial O, oh. Where's the flood of fire, the secret and the skirt? Where the blessedness of yes, the kingdom come? I mouth these syllables unborn, embryonic commas yet to form, between my elbows and her thigh, these fingers set to charm. So harm me, God.
Do you have a favorite offbeat? I mean, bars, casinos, but then you know, libraries, things like that too. But do you have a favorite offbeat places where you like to, you know, to?
Yeah, if I can answer the question a little more generally.
Sure.
I had a dilemma. I'd been in Orange County for 30 years. Very politically insular, very conservative, but I had the good fortune to live at the beach, which was not the real world. However, to balance that, I commuted to a community college every day where I taught English for 32 years. Rode the bus, as a poet said, with other workers facing the rush hour dawn to stay close to the people, to help me to create poems that would be more populist and more understandable to the shipping clerk, to the waitress, to the server, And so that kept me very much grounded in the real world. Anyway, I became known in poetry. They called me the porn star of poetry, the poetry pimp, but never a poetry poser, because as much as people can be flamboyant in poetry readings, my dictum is that nobody should presume to present a poem at a reading, be it a coffee house or a bar, unless they would be proud to have it published as solid print poetry first. And then if they can add some drama to the delivery, if they can make it more exciting, again, that will attract a reader. So in summary, I came from being known in California to a place pretty late in life where I'm totally unknown. So I actually made a plan, which sometimes poets aren't so good at. But I decided that I would come and read in a coffee house, space my features out by a couple of months or so, and then I would do something that I'm told is pretty unprecedented, and that's to get a reading in an odd place, which would be a casino.
A casino.
And I remember the marketing director saying, "Well, Mr. Mallory, what is your poetry reading in here going to do for our bottom line?" And I said, "Well, you ought to know I'm out to put poetry on the map, and I need to try doubly hard because I'm new in this town, and I'll get you the first free ink you never had to pay for." In other words, get some public notice.
That's a good answer.
Then found my name up on a 45-foot marquee one night right above the $2.99 breakfast special, which seemed to me quite a logical place to put
billing.
A poet.
That's good.
Anyway, take a reading into a bar lounge, and now take a reading into a real dive bar, which I'm told is iconic in Las Vegas. It's the Double Down Saloon on September 7th, and we'll see about that.
Some time ago, we had a conversation with a young lady who was, along with a couple of other friends in the writing program at UNLV, had started reading poems on buses. And I gather that it sounds like she would be very much in line with some of the things that you've done.
Well, putting poetry on buses is would be a symbol of everything I'm trying to do, which is get the poetry to the people. Like Lawrence Ferlinghetti said, get the poetry out to the masses. Poetry scene, although I said it was a big tent, can be very incestuous, where you have poets lined up listening to other poets in coffee houses. And excuse the cliche, it's really just singing to the choir. Better to take a reading into a new place, try to provoke people who are mildly interested or even disinterested, and get them to pay attention. That's the real challenge for the poet.
You can see the body language change.
Yeah.
As they begin to dial into what you're saying.
I ran the longest running reading in Orange County, which went 25 years. And we went through 7 venues. One had a homicide, one was firebombed, several went bankrupt. But the crowds kept coming back, and they followed us from venue to venue to venue wherever we went, because they found that poetry was relevant.
This all just sounds so much, so Bukowskian, if you will. And you know, you have been inspired by his works.
When I was a student in 1968 at UC Santa Barbara, at the time, the biggest poet on campus who was a lecturer then and already published widely in the world was Kenneth Rexroth, who wrote very romantic work, celebrated in translating the best Asian poetry, very elaborated, you might say, highbrow work. Then came a guy on the scene named Charles Bukowski, whom I met through a brother-in-law, and who was the complete antithesis, the absolute au contraire of Kenneth Rexroth. In fact, I think it's fair to say they pretty much despised one another. I'd go down to visit Bukowski on the weekends to his dive of a bungalow littered with beer cans almost everywhere, but he would sit quietly, contemplatively on the couch, hang out for him with the weekend, talking about the racetracks and the booze and the women and the one-night stands. Maybe he'd show me his most recently cut lip, and then be back in class on the following Monday or Tuesday with Rexroth, whom Bukowski said was just an academic standing beside the pencil sharpener, refining himself out of existence. And Rexroth would say, "Why are you hanging out with that lowlife who's not a poet at all? He's just writing about puking in the alleyways and the meanness of the streets and the beauty of the high school girls and how it's too painful to look." But he said, "That's not poetry." Bukowski would shoot back and say, "Rexroth's not even in this real world. Nobody really cares about what he says. You know, everybody can look at the moon. Why write endlessly about it? So I was torn between these two poles.
Yeah, some tug of war that must have been.
Became an odd hybrid. Lee Mallory is an odd hybrid. But I was close to Bukowski. Fair to say, in some ways, he mentored me. He taught me to bring poetry back to basics. And by then, he was becoming famous in all the world. But a very confrontational guy.
Yeah, and not, by all accounts, not by any means the nicest of guys.
No, constantly testing. First of all, if you were a young poet, he called you one of the sharks, and you literally couldn't get into his little place unless you brought a 12-pack of beer. So he drank endlessly. Here's a guy with two little tiny chapbooks, me, a little punk like Mallory, telling him that maybe his behavior was a bit too self-destructive, which would enrage him and which would risk my position of being anywhere close to him. But he was by nature drunk most of the time. It didn't affect some of his most powerful and beautiful writing, and very confrontational, constantly testing. I remember parties where he'd just single out a guest. One night he chose me out. All the literati in Los Angeles were at this party. I think it was a New Year's Eve party. And I was the guest who was unfortunate enough and unschooled enough to arrive with a green tie. Well, that was like Dostoevsky going to the important party and noticing a mustard stain on his best jacket. Feeling a little out of place anyway, Bukowski calls me to the center of the room. He's drunk, very drunk. Pulls me right up nose to nose and says, "Mallory, what do you think of my face? Tell me about my face. What do you think about it?" And the room went into a hush, and people actually crowded up against the walls. I felt like a fighter in a ring, stuck. But the little guy, in the face of the big guy, knowing that if I flinched, if I hesitated just 1 minute, I'd be sent to the door, never invited back. I leaned in, about 6 inches from him, nose to nose. I said, "Buck, it's an ugly face. It's a flare-scorched face. It looks like it's been bitten by red ants." And I remember the proverbial hush in the room, and he leaned in closer to me. And immediately I said, "Young punk Mallory, the shark, you went too far. You pushed him too far." He looked at me with rage in his eyes. He actually looked at me like he was going to kill me. There wasn't a hush in the room. And those seconds that people talk about as being endless seemed like a minute, but it was probably 5 seconds. We just looked at each other nose to nose. "Mallory, you've gone too far," I said over and over to myself. And then he threw his head back suddenly, broke the tension, roared, laughed, and said, "Go get a beer, kid." Immediately I knew I'd passed the test. But in the same way that he tested you in social settings, he tested your poems. Bring him 10 poems, he just tossed the first 6 on the floor. "Doesn't suffer its moment. Back to the drawing boards. This isn't poetry." And then he'd get a good one and he'd say, "Well, maybe there's something here. You better work on it." Of course, that diminutive compliment coming from him meant the world. "You better work on it. Kid, wait on the word. She's more faithful than any woman. On mornings of doom, have a drink or two and wait. Wait on the word. Even though they'll never give us the keys to City Hall, nor will we be able to sniff the insides of Elizabeth Taylor's shoes. Wait on the word," he said.
Lee Mallory, for many years, taught poetry in California and recently moved to Las Vegas. If you hear a poet in casinos, bars, and the Double Down on September 7th, that's likely going to be him. Thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you among us.
Thank you for hosting a poet.